It had been a shock meeting Selver face to face. As he flew back to Central from the foothill village, Lyubov tried to decide why it had been a shock. For after all, one isn't usually terrified by a chance meeting with a good friend. It hadn't been easy to get the head woman to invite him. Tuntar had been his main locus of study all summer. He had several excellent informants there and was on good terms with the lodge and with the head woman, who had let him observe and participate in the community freely. Wangling an actual invitation out of her had taken a long time, but at last she had complied, giving him, according to the new directives, a genuine occasion arranged by the Athshians. His own conscience, rather than the colonel, had insisted on this. Dong wanted him to go. He was worried about the Creechy threat. He told Lyubov to size them up, to see how they're reacting now that we're leaving them strictly alone. He hoped for reassurance. Lyubov couldn't decide whether the report he'd be turning in would reassure the colonel or not. For 10 miles out of Central, the plain had been logged and the stumps had all rotted away. It was now a great, dull flat of fiberweed, hairy gray in the rain. Under those hirsute leaves, the seedling shrubs got their first growth, the sumacs, dwarf aspens, and salviforms, which, grown, would in turn protect the seedling trees. Left alone in this even, rainy climate, this area might reforest itself within 30 years and reattain the full climax forest within 100, left alone. Suddenly the forest began again. Under the helicopter, the infinitely various green of leaves covered the slow swells and folding of the hills of North Sornal. Like most Terrans on Terra, Lyubov had never walked among wild trees at all, never seen a wood larger than a city block. At first on Athsha, he had felt oppressed and uneasy in the forest, stifled by its endless crowd and incoherence of trunks, branches, leaves, and the perpetual greenish or brownish twilight. The silence made up of many little meaningless noises, the total vegetable indifference to the presence of mind, all this had troubled him. And like the others, he had kept to clearings and to the beach. But little by little, he had begun to like it. And now, after 4 years of it, he was completely at home under the trees, more so, perhaps, than anywhere else. He had also come to like the Athshians' names for their own lands and places, sonorous, two-syllabled words. Sornal, Tuntar, Eshref, Eshsen, that was now Centralville, Entor, Abton, and above all, Athsha, which meant the forest and the world. So Earth, Terra, meant both the soil and the planet, two meanings in one. But to the Athshian, soil, ground, earth, was not that to which the dead return and by which the living live. The substance of their world was not earth, but forest. Terran man was clay, red dust. Athshian man was branch and root. He brought the hopper down in a small glade north of the town and walked in past the women's lodge. The smell of an Athshian settlement hung pungent in the air. Wood smoke, dead fish, aromatic herbs, alien sweat. Lyubov had spent many intellectually stimulating hours doubled up and suffocating in the reeking gloom of the men's lodge in Tuntar. But it didn't look as if he would be invited in this time. Of course, the townsfolk knew of the Smith Camp massacre now 6 weeks ago. They would have known of it soon, for word got around fast among the islands. The townsfolk also knew that the 1,200 slaves at Centralville had been freed soon after the Smith Camp massacre, and Lyubov agreed with the colonel that the natives might take the second event to be a result of the first. What was important was that the slaves had been freed. Wrongs done could not be righted, but at least they were not still being done. They could start over. The natives, without that painful, unanswerable wonder as to why the humans treated men like animals, and he without the burden of explanation and the gnawing of irremediable guilt. Knowing how they valued candor and direct speech concerning frightening matters, he expected that people in Tuntar would talk about these things with him in triumph or apology or puzzlement. No one did. No one said much of anything to him. He had come in late afternoon, which was like arriving in a Terran city just after dawn. Athshians did sleep, but their physiological lull was between noon and 4 p.m., whereas with Terrans, it is usually between 2 and 5 a.m., and they had a double peak cycle of high temperature and high activity coming in the two twilights, dawn and evening. Most adults slept 5 or 6 hours in 24, in several catnaps, and adept men slept as little as 2 hours in 24. So if one discounted both their naps and their dreaming states as laziness, one might say they never slept. At this point in Tantar, things were just beginning to stir again after the late day slump. Lyubov noticed a good many strangers. They looked at him, but none approached. They were mere presences passing on other paths in the dusk of the great oaks. At last, someone he knew came along his path, the head woman's cousin, Sherar, an old woman of small importance and small understanding. She greeted him civilly, but did not or would not respond to his inquiries about the head woman and his two best informants, Egath, the orchard keeper, and Tubab, the dreamer. She stuck to Lyubov, and nobody else spoke to him. He worked his way, accompanied by the hobbling, complaining, tiny green crone, across the groves and glades of Tantar to the men's lodge.
"They're busy in there dreaming. Come along now, Lyubov. Come see the fishing nets."
A girl passed by, one of the young hunters, looked up at him, a stare of animosity such as he had never received from any Athshian, unless perhaps from a little girl, frightened into scowling by his height and his hairless face. But this child was not frightened. If the Athshians had indeed developed, at last and abruptly, the sense of group enmity, then he must accept this and simply try to show them that he remained a reliable friend. But how could their way of feeling and thinking have changed so fast after so long? And why? At Smith Camp, provocation had been immediate and intolerable. Davison's cruelty would drive even Athshians to violence. But this town, Tantar, had never been attacked by the Terrans, had suffered no slave raids, had not seen the local forest logged or burned. They had got the news from Smith, and there were among them now refugees, ex-slaves, who had suffered at the Terrans' hands and would talk about it. But would news and hearsay change the hearers, change them radically? When their unaggressiveness ran so deep in them, right through their culture and society and on down into their subconscious, their dream time, and perhaps into their very physiology? That an Athshian could be provoked by atrocious cruelty to attempt murder, he knew. He had seen it happen once. That a disrupted community might be similarly provoked by similarly intolerable injuries, he had to believe. It had happened at Smith Camp. But that talk and hearsay, no matter how frightening and outrageous, could enrage a settled community of these people to the point where they acted against their customs and reason, broke entirely out of their whole style of living, this he couldn't believe. Some element was missing. Old Tubab came out of the lodge just as Lyubov passed in front of it. Behind the old man came Selver. Selver crawled out of the tunnel door, stood upright, blinked at the rain-grayed, foliage-dimmed brightness of daylight. His dark eyes met Lyubov's, looking up. Neither spoke. Lyubov was badly frightened. Flying home in the hopper, analyzing the shock, he thought, why fear? Why was I afraid of Selver? Unprovable intuition? Nothing between Selver and Lyubov had changed. What Selver had done at Smith Camp could be justified. Even if it couldn't be justified, it made no difference. The friendship between them was too deep to be touched by moral doubt. They had worked very hard together. They had taught each other, in rather more than the literal sense, their languages. They had spoken without reserve. And Lyubov's love for his friend was deepened by that gratitude the Savior feels toward the one whose life he has been privileged to save. Indeed, he had scarcely realized until that moment how deep his liking and loyalty to Selver were. Had his fear, in fact, been the personal fear that Selver might, having learned racial hatred, reject him and treat him not as you, but as one of them? After that long first gaze, Selver came forward slowly and greeted Lyubov, holding out his hands. Touch was a main channel of communication among the forest people. Caress as signal and reassurance was as essential to them as it is to mother and child or to lover and lover. But its significance was social, not only maternal and sexual. It was part of their language. It was therefore patterned, codified, yet infinitely modifiable. So Selver came forward with his hands held out, shook Lyubov's hand, Terran fashion, and then took both his arms in a stroking motion just above the elbow. He was not much more than half Lyubov's height, which made all the gestures difficult and ungainly for both of them, but there was nothing uncertain or childlike in the touch of his small, thin, green-furred hand on Lyubov's arms. It was reassurance. Lyubov was very glad to get it.
"Selver, what luck to meet you here. I want very much to talk with you."
"I can't now, Lyubov." Lyubov's hope of an unaltered friendship vanished. Selver had changed. He was changed radically from the root.
Can I come back another day and talk with you, Selver? It is important to me. I leave here today.
Selver let go Lyubov's arms and looked away. He thus put himself literally out of touch. Civility required that Lyubov do the same and let the conversation end. But then there would be no one to talk to. Old Tubab had not even looked at him. The town had turned its back on him. And this was Selver, who had been his friend.
Selver, this killing at Kelmedeva, maybe you think that lies between us, but it does not. Maybe it brings us closer together. And your people in the slave pens, they've all been set free, so that wrong no longer lies between us. And even if it does, it always did. All the same, I am the same man I was, Selver.
At first, the Athshian made no response. His strange face turned from Lyubov. Then suddenly he looked round as if against his own intent.
Lyubov, you shouldn't have come here. You should leave Central 2 nights from now. I don't know what you are. It would be better if I had never known you.
And with that, he was off. A light walk like a long-legged cat. A green flicker among the dark oaks of Tantar. Gone. Tubab followed slowly after him, still without a glance at Lyubov. A fine rain fell without sound on the oak leaves and on the narrow pathways to the lodge and the river. He tried to tell himself that Selver had not been rejecting him as Lyubov, but him as a Terran. It made no difference. It never does. For 2 years, Lyubov had been traveling, studying, interviewing, observing, and had failed to get at the key that would let him into the Athshian mind. He had studied the Athshian's sleeping habits and found that they apparently had no sleeping habits. He had wired countless electrodes onto countless furry green skulls and failed to make any sense at all out of the familiar patterns, the spindles and jags, the alphas and deltas and thetas that appeared on the graph. It was Selver who had made him understand, at last, the Athshian significance of the word dream, which was also the word for root, and so hand him the key of the kingdom of the forest people. It was with Selver as EEG subject that he had first seen with comprehension the extraordinary impulse patterns of a brain entering a dream state neither sleeping nor awake, a condition which related to Terran dream sleeping as the Parthenon to a mud hut. The same thing, basically, but with the addition of complexity, quality, and control. Selver might have escaped. He stayed, first as a valet, then as scientific aide, still locked up nightly with all the other creatures in the pen.
"I'll fly you to Tantar and work with you there," Lyubov had said, about the third time he talked with Selver. "For God's sake, why stay here?"
"My wife, Thela, is in the pen," Selver had said. Lyubov had tried to get her released, but she was in the HQ kitchen, and the sergeants who managed the kitchen gang resented any interference from brass and speches. Lyubov had to be very careful, lest they take out their resentment on the woman. She and Selver had both seemed willing to wait patiently until both could escape or be freed. Male and female creatures were strictly segregated in the pens, and husband and wife rarely saw each other. Lyubov managed to arrange meetings for them in his hut, which he had to himself at the north end of town. It was when Thela was returning to HQ from one such meeting that Davison had seen her and apparently been struck by her frail, frightened grace. He had had her brought to his quarters that night and had raped her. He had killed her in the act. Perhaps this had happened before, a result of the physical disparity, or else she had stopped living. Like some Terrans, the Athshians had the knack of authentic death wish and could cease to live. In either case, it was Davison who had killed her. Such murders had occurred before. What had not occurred before was what Selver did the second day after her death. Lyubov got there only at the end. He could recall the sounds, himself running down Main Street in hot sunlight, the dust, the knot of men. The whole thing could have lasted only 5 minutes. When Lyubov got there, Selver was blinded with blood, a sort of toy for Davison to play with, and yet he had picked himself up and was coming back, not with berserk rage, but with intelligent despair. He kept coming back. It was Davison who was scared into rage at last by that terrible persistence. Knocking Selver down with a side blow, he had moved forward, lifting his booted foot to stamp on the skull. Even as he moved, Lyubov had broken into the circle. He stopped the fight. And thenceforth, he hated Davison and was hated by him, having come between the killer and his death. For if it's all the rest of us who are killed by the suicide, it's himself whom the murderer kills. Only he has to do it over and over. Lyubov had picked up Selver, a lightweight in his arms. The mutilated face had pressed against his shirt so that the blood soaked through against his own skin. He had taken Selver to his own bungalow, splinted his broken wrist, done what he could for his face, kept him in his own bed, night after night tried to talk to him, to reach him in the desolation of his grief and shame. It was, of course, against regulations. Nobody mentioned the regulations to him. They did not have to. He knew he was forfeiting most of what favor he had ever had with the officers of the colony. Davison, curiously infuriated by the minor injuries Selver had done him and by Lyubov's interference, had gone around saying he intended to finish off that rebel Creechy. He certainly would do so if he got the chance. Lyubov stayed with Selver night and day for 2 weeks and then flew him out of Central and put him down in a West Coast town, Broter, where he had relatives. There was no penalty for aiding slaves to escape, since the Athsians were not slaves at all, except in fact. Lyubov was not even reprimanded. But the regular officers distrusted him totally, instead of partially, from then on. And even his colleagues in the special services, the exobiologists, the ag and forestry coordinators, the ecologist, variously let him know that he had been irrational or stupid. "Did you think you were going on a picnic?" Gossa had demanded. "No, I didn't think it would be any bloody picnic." "I can't see why any Hilfer voluntarily ties himself up to an open colony. You know the people you're studying are going to get plowed under and probably wiped out. It's the way things are. It's human nature. You must know you can't change that. Then why come and watch the process? Masochism? I don't know what human nature is. Maybe leaving descriptions of what we wipe out is part of human nature. Is it much pleasanter for an ecologist, really?" "All right, then, write up your descriptions, but keep out of the carnage. A biologist studying a rat colony doesn't start reaching in and rescuing pet rats of his that get attacked, you know." At this, Lyubov had blown loose. He had taken too much. "No, of course not. A rat can be a pet, but not a friend." That had hurt poor old Gossa, who wanted to be a father figure to Lyubov. And it had done nobody any good. Yet it had been true. "I like Selver, respect him, saved him, suffered with him, fear him. Selver is my friend. Selver is a god. Selver Sha'ab." What did Sha'ab mean, though? Many words of the women's tongue, the everyday speech of the Athsians, came from the men's tongue that was the same in all communities. And these words often were not only two-syllabled, but two-sided. Sha'ab meant god, or numinous entity, or powerful being. It also meant something quite different, but Lyubov could not remember what. By this stage in his thinking, he was home in his bungalow, and had only to look it up in the dictionary which he and Selver had compiled in 4 months of exhausting but harmonious work. Of course, Sha'ab, translator. It was almost too pat. Were the two meanings connected? Often they were, yet not so often as to constitute a rule. If a god was a translator, what did he translate? Was a Sha'ab one who translated the language of dream and philosophy, the men's tongue, into the everyday speech? But all dreamers could do that. Might he then be one who could translate into waking life the central experience of vision, one serving as a link between the two realities considered by the Athsians as equal, the dream time and the world time, whose connections, though vital, are obscure? A link. One who could speak aloud the perceptions of the subconscious. To speak that tongue is to act, to do a new thing, to change or to be changed radically from the root. For the root is the dream, and the translator is the god. Selver had brought a new word into the language of his people. He had done a new deed. The word, the deed, murder. Only a god could lead so great a newcomer as death across the bridge between the worlds. But had he learned to kill his fellow men among his own dreams of outrage and bereavement, or from the undreamed of actions of the strangers? Was he speaking his own language, or was he speaking Captain Davison's? That which seemed to rise from the root of his own suffering and express his own changed being might in fact be an infection, a foreign plague, which would not make a new people of his race, but would destroy them. Raj Lyubov's character and training disposed him not to interfere in other men's business. His job was to find out what they did, and his inclination was to let them go on doing it. But even the most unmissionary soul, unless he pretends he has no emotions, is sometimes faced with a choice between commission and omission. What are they doing abruptly becomes, what are we doing? And then, what must I do? That he had reached such a point of choice now, he knew, and yet did not know clearly why, nor what alternatives were offered him. He could do no more to improve the Athsheans' chance of survival at the moment. Le Pennon, Orr, and the Ansible had done more than he had hoped to see done in his lifetime. The administration on Terra was explicit in every Ansible communication, and Colonel Dong, though under pressure from some of his staff and the logging bosses to ignore the directives, was carrying out orders. Policy was no longer static. A decision by the League of Worlds might now lead overnight to the colonies being limited to one land, or forbidden to cut trees, or encouraged to kill natives. No telling. How the League worked and what sort of policies it was developing could not yet be guessed from the flat directives of the administration. The colonists were letting the Athsheans alone, and they were letting the colonists alone. A healthy situation, and one not to be disturbed unnecessarily. The only thing likely to disturb it was fear. At the moment, the Athsheans might be expected to be suspicious and still resentful, but not particularly afraid. As for the panic felt in Centralville at the news of the Smith Camp massacre, nothing had happened to revive it. No Athsheian anywhere had shown any violence since, and with the slaves gone, the Creechies all vanished back into their forests, there was no more constant irritation of xenophobia. The colonists were at last beginning to relax. If Lyubov reported that he had seen Selver at Tantar, Dong and the others would be alarmed. They might insist on trying to capture Selver and bring him in for trial. The colonial code forbade prosecution of a member of one planetary society under the laws of another, but the court-martial overrode such distinctions. They could try, convict, and shoot Selver. So he made his choice without even knowing he had made one. He turned in a brief report that next day. It said that Tantar was going about its business as usual, and that he had not been turned away or threatened. It was a soothing report, and the most inaccurate one Lyubov ever wrote. It omitted everything of significance. Otherwise, the report was quite factual, he thought. He had merely omitted subjective impressions, as a scientist should. He had a severe migraine while writing the report, and a worse one after submitting it. He dreamed a lot that night, but could not remember his dreams in the morning. Late in the second night after his visit to Tantar, he woke, and in the hysterical whooping of the alarm siren and the thudding of explosions, he faced at last what he had refused. He was the only man in Centralville not taken by surprise. In that moment, he knew what he was. A traitor. And yet even now it was not clear in his mind that this was an Athsheian raid. It was the terror in the night. His own hut had been ignored, standing in its yard away from other houses. Perhaps the trees around it protected it, he thought as he hurried out. The center of town was all on fire. Even the stone cube of HQ burned from within like a broken kiln. The Ansible was in there, the precious link. There were fires also in the direction of the helicopter port and the field. Where had they got explosives? How had the fires got going all at once? All the buildings along both sides of Main Street, built of wood, were burning. The sound of the burning was terrible. Lyubov ran towards the fires. Water flooded the way. He thought at first it was from a fire hose, then realized the main from the river Menand was flooding uselessly over the ground while the houses burned with that hideous sucking roar. How had they done this? There were guards. There were always guards in jeeps at the field. Shots, volleys, the yatter of a machine gun. All around Lyubov were small running figures, but he ran among them without giving them much thought. He was abreast of the hostel now, and saw a girl standing in the doorway, fire flickering at her back, and a clear escape before her. She did not move. He shouted at her, then ran across the yard to her and wrested her hands free of the door jams, which she clung to in panic, pulling her away by force. She came then, but not quite soon enough. As they crossed the yard, the front of the upper story, blazing from within, fell slowly forward, pushed by the timbers of the collapsing roof. Shingles and beams shot out like shell fragments. A blazing beam end struck Lyubov and knocked him sprawling. He lay face down in the firelit lake of mud. He did not see a little green-furred huntress leap at the girl, drag her down backwards, and cut her throat. He did not see anything.